This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And still to come in the second half of today's show, we check in with Karen Ahrens with Hunger Free North Dakota about Hunger Awareness Month and how hunger is happening and how they are addressing those problems during a global pandemic. But joining me now from our Grand Forks studio is Dr. Vasil Takech. He is a professor of biology at the University of North Dakota and the current president of the American Society of Parasitologists, a position he has held since the end of July. Dr. Takech, thanks so much for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
What is the American Society of Parasitologists?
American Society of Parasitologists, and that's straight from our website, more or less, is a diverse group of about 700, depending on the year, scientists from academia, industry, and government who are involved in the study or teaching of the scientific discipline of parasitology. And society members collectively and individually contribute to the development of this science as a discipline, as well as doing research in biochemistry, ecology, immunology, medicine, molecular biology, everything that's related to parasites.
And I love this. In doing a little bit of research yesterday, I came across the sentence that anybody interested in this field is interested in the most common and least loved life form on Earth.
Yes.
Do you remember what first drew you to parasites?
Well, that's fairly easy to remember because as an undergraduate student, as you can tell from my accent, I'm not born in the United States. I'm a Ukrainian by origin. And as an undergraduate student, I happened to live in a dorm room with two other students who actually already started studying parasites. I wanted to study plants, orchids, in particular, the beautiful things, right?
Yeah.
However, when one of the days I helped one of my roommates with his research and I saw a tapeworm live, contracting and moving, and I was mesmerized and I was involved with parasites since then. It's very interesting. It is maybe the least loved, but one of the most interesting forms of life on Earth, definitely.
What captures your interest particularly about that specific worm? Because most people would see that and you know, make a gross out face.
Well, the idea of a living creature inside another organism is not trivial, and it is as fascinated to me now, 30-something years later, as it was on the day one. And just being able to adapt to this extremely aggressive environment that we as, well, humans is just one of the organisms, but every other organism tries to fight those parasites inside them.
Yeah.
And yet parasites evolved and managed to adapt and survive and do pretty well.
Well, I would think so, to become the most abundant life form known, anyway, on Earth. I think most people have a loose understanding of that parasite-host relationship. Perhaps you could shed a little bit more light on at least how the majority of the parasitic-host relationship works. They can't live without a host.
Well, that's another aspect of parasites and parasitology that makes it extremely interesting. To be a parasitologist, a good parasitologist, you need to be a well-rounded biologist because, as you correctly pointed out, it needs a host.
Mm-hmm.
But the majority of parasites, especially parasitic worms that I deal with, have complex life cycles. So that might be a surprise to many, but to end up in a host like a human or heron, a bird, a parasite might need to go to the water first, go find a snail, then go to a fish, and then being eaten by a human or a heron to become adult. So very complex life cycles, and they need all these elements, not just one host. So they're pretty good indicators of the ecosystem health.
What can we tell about the health of our planet, or at least that immediate surroundings, by the health of how the local parasites are doing?
That's another great question. And actually, just about a week or 2 weeks ago, our colleagues from California have published a very interesting research that basically raises the question of conservation or conserving the parasites.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Some of them are ready to be extinct. And, well, one would say, who cares? Good riddance, right? But we should not always think of parasites as these nasty things that only cause diseases.
Mm.
So that's the other answer to your question. Of parasites as parts of ecosystems, I must say that parasites become violent, cause obvious visible diseases, mortality, morbidity, more often than not when conditions are shifted in some way, when they're changed in an abnormal way, when the hosts, such as humans or domestic animals, are concentrated beyond normal population density, or they're introduced to new areas where they're not native and can either pick up a local parasite or bring in new parasites, and local unadapted animals may suffer. So all these aspects, basically, when there is some sort of disturbance in a system, that creates kind of better conditions for parasites to be to cause disease.
Mm.
Otherwise, they have evolved to live in some sort of harmony with the host, to the point that most of them are not interested to kill the host because they die with it.
Right. But they can make them very sick. I mean, a parasite is what makes the mosquito a very deadly insect, carrying with it malaria.
Yeah, absolutely. Malaria is no doubt the worst, the most prevalent and deadliest parasitic disease on Earth. We have a faculty in my department, Dr. Jefferson Wan, who works with malaria for a number of years and studies the transmission and mosquitoes. It was interesting to me to work with him in Southeast Asia and see how the work on malaria is done in the field. Lots of progress is being done, though.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned Southeast Asia, and I noticed on your website, too, that you had done a lot of work in Brazil. And I know whenever, especially people from this area, go traveling in tropical areas, there is lots of either prophylactic medicine or what have you that people need to take for some of these conditions. And I don't know how much of that is just because we're not used to these bugs, or if they definitely can thrive in these humid conditions more so than where it gets real cold.
The parasitic diseases are definitely much more common and prevalent in tropic environments. And I can't tell you how many countries, but I work in the Philippines, Australia, Vietnam, Laos, Thailand,
all
Chile,
Peru, places.
And Brazil and Uganda, so and so forth. It is important to be educated. And if you are prepared, then the danger is much lower. On the other hand, even if you think you're going into the well-manicured resort somewhere, especially in countries like Mexico, for instance, it doesn't mean the parasites are not there. Just be prepared. I, from all these travels, I never had any vector-borne or another parasitic disease because, well, I'm prepared and educated about it. So, and that's what I recommend to others. There's a CDC website. Your travel doctor will tell you what to do. But just wearing long sleeve shirts and long sleeve pants and using bug spray, that basically the recipe for to protect yourself from most diseases. So.
In your studies in various countries across the world, are you focused exclusively on the parasites, or do you ever get into how, for example, the native population might deal with these parasites that would be different? And I'm thinking, you know, deep in the Amazon, there might be some plant-based medicine that we wouldn't necessarily use in the U.S.
Well, I must say that I work primarily with parasites and diseases of wild animals, okay. Less so humans. However, I was involved in several studies that involve human parasites. And yes, some of these remedies have been known for a long, long time in different societies. There are natural anthelmintics, for instance. Mm-hmm. And there were recently some alternatives to drugs that come from pharmaceutical companies that are based on plants, for instance. They were manufactured in, or proponents of such drugs, particularly were from China, for instance. Mm-hmm. And it's been relatively successful. It looks like I do not have exact numbers, so I cannot elaborate on that. But there are definitely natural remedies that different societies, peoples used around the world before the modern medicine was even developed.
We're visiting today with Dr. Vasil Takach. He is a professor of biology at the University of North Dakota and the president of the American Society of Parasitologists. Dr. Takach, what do you hope to accomplish as president of the American Society of Parasitologists?
Well, first of all, this is a very unusual year, of course. This is the first year since World War II when we did not have our annual meeting. Mm. Well, we are preparing plan to have a meeting next year. Doesn't matter in what format, if things improve face-to-face, but likely virtual. Just in 2 days, there will be a meeting of one of our regional societies. We have affiliated societies all over the country. Our region is belongs to Midwestern Society, for instance, and so they have their own meetings. But most of all, we try to use actually this opportunity and consider it as opportunity to connect at least digitally with a broader parasitological community and society in general through digital platforms of different kinds to try to attract more new younger members, students. So my focus is on bringing as many as possible young aspiring parasitologists to the society and have them interested in the discipline, start on research and contribute to the development of discipline and society in general. We had this last spring a so-called parasite hour where people well, expert and non-expert from around the world could join, and some of the speakers were from different countries, including Africa, for instance, a couple of countries in Africa, where everyone could join. Another initiative that was started by one of our members, actually a student representative, and that will run its third year, is a National Parasite Week. We had a Parasite Day the year before, and this year we had in spring a National Parasite Week.
What do you do for Parasite Week?
When the members of the society connect with great school teachers and classrooms around the country and the world. I met with two such classes in Iowa and Florida, and this is very interesting, and having these school students listening and asking their questions is enlightening to me and very educational to me, hopefully to them as well, but definitely to me. And there might be a follow-up. We had a very good feedback after those meetings, and we plan to expand that.
Oh, that's wonderful. Do you find that there is a fairly diverse group of students interested in parasitology? I know some fields of science tend to be more heavily male, some are more heavily female. How do you find the diversity of the student base?
Well, student-wise, they are definitely, well, both the membership of the society and students involved, so most members of the society who are faculty have a group, larger or smaller, of students, so that is a fairly large network, and it is pretty diverse. We try, and we have in our policies and our mission statements the ideas about increasing and supporting the diversity of our members. Gender-wise, I must say that in my lab for over the years, majority of undergraduate students were female students. I had a large number of very, very good students. And coming to the meetings, I think it's about 50-50 in our society.
I'm on the American Society of Parasitologists website, and I'm looking at the section of different careers, and one of them is medical parasitology, and it addresses right away what I was thinking, is that we only study parasites in the role of causing human disease, or I should say people think of them in terms of causing disease. And I'm wondering, from a scientific perspective, of course, you're looking at them for different reasons, but do parasites, I mean, do they do any good?
Well, one of the things they do good is they, unless there are too many of them, they train the immune system of their host. And this is a large and development field of parasitology, or I guess an aspect of parasitology. One of our recent presidents of the American Society of Parasitologists, Dr. John Harden, he works on hookworms, the nematodes that, well, they can cause disease, but at the same time, in the current kind of age of increasing immune deficiency and autoimmune diseases, the general thinking is that many of the people in the industrialized countries are simply not exposed to enough antigens as they grow, as they go through their lives, and our immune system kind of is not practicing enough before they actually encounter a a dangerous antigen, a dangerous disease agent. And there are studies that try to use kind of moderate, balanced amount of parasites, roundworms in this mm-hmm. case, to try to fix that, to correct the immune responses and train the system.
Okay, yeah, mild exposure. You know, I wonder, because you mentioned too that this is a very weird year for, well, everyone, but specifically the American Society of Parasitologists. And I'm wondering, in your research, are you finding that there are parallels between how parasites move through this world and how viruses move through this world? And especially based on what you just said about that mild exposure to train the immune system, has the pandemic, even though it's viral, provided any research opportunities or even just ability to collaborate with other types of scientists between parasites and viruses?
Well, first of all, I must say that I'm not a virologist, so I cannot speak professionally enough on that topic. So I would I prefer to avoid any statements on that matter. However, all things are connected. And at least in wild animals, especially in cases when populations are overcrowded, as people mostly are, there is always connection between, say, multicellular endoparasites such as worms and infectious agents such as bacteria and viruses, and presence of one of them or actual disease condition caused by one of them usually makes things easier to the other. So there was a saying of one of the very large names in parasitology and helminthology, who said that helminths or parasitic worms open the gates to infection. So once one parasite takes some energy and some resources from an organism, the others have it easier. And when it comes to pandemics, well, in many ways, limited travel slows other parasite movement and infection movement down. So,
Dr. Vasil Takach is a professor of biology at the University of North Dakota and the president of the American Society of Parasitologists. Dr. Takach, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks. It was great being with you.
Still to come on Main Street, we look at hunger in North Dakota. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Governor Burgum says the state has hired more contact tracers to help track the number of potential contacts with individuals who test positive for COVID-19.
Because we know when we got into the 15 to 29-year-old, you know, when we started this thing out, the average number of contacts someone might have had might have been like 5 or 6 contacts. You get into people that are showing back on the campus and they have a lot of contacts, it just takes more work.
Burgum says although part of the system has been automated in terms of aggregating data as to whether the contacts were community spread or travel related,
but it still takes contact tracers who've been trained on the phone talking to individuals and calling individuals.
West Fargo Public Schools is now the second largest school district in the state, behind Bismarck and surpassing Fargo. There are 11,728 students enrolled in preschool through 12th grade. Last month, the school board approved district's return to learn plan with 2 start dates, September 3rd and September 8th. As with most school districts, West Fargo expects the official enrollment will fluctuate the first month of school. And North Dakota schools will be sharing in $30 million from the CARES Act. Each K-12 district will receive a base payment, and the rest will be divvied up by per-student payments. That funding was approved by the state's Emergency Commission. Governor Burgum chairs that commission.
explicitly being able to be used for making sure that we have enough staff to keep teaching. Again, whether it's substitute teachers or others that we need to bring in to make sure that if someone is come in close contact and they have to be quarantined or isolated, they're out of the workforce, just to make sure we got enough workforce to keep going to the schools.
The spending plan must still be approved by the legislature's budget section. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight,
welcome to a scientific revolution. You'll discover why you can be hacked without even knowing. We'll explore how marketers and corporations hack your mind. And we'll go inside the political campaigns that brought corporate-style hacking to politics. This is Hacking Your Mind. And if you want to find out how to keep others from getting control of your mind and take control of it yourself, come around the world with us.
Watch Hacking Your Mind tonight at 9 Central, 8 o'clock Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And last week, historian Dr. Tom Ezern introduced us to the art of song catching. And today he follows up by tracing a song catcher's family tree.
George F. Will of Bismarck, ethnologist, archaeologist, dendrochronologist, and son of the celebrated horticulturalist and seedsman Oscar Will, was also, as disclosed in a previous essay, a song catcher, a lover and collector of folk songs, particularly cowboy ballads. He published his folk song findings in the Journal of American Folklore in 1909 and 1913. Happily, in his 1913 article entitled Four Cowboy Songs, Will provides the names of his informants: William Sunderland, E.R. Steinbrück, and Arthur Bivens. Perhaps we can trace the path of the song catcher, young George Will, and see what sort of characters he got his material from. William Sunderland gave Will two songs: Punching Cows, a comic lament of a tenderfoot set up to fail as a cowhand, and The Texas Ranger, which is a song with origins in a better-known ballad, The Buffalo Skinners. My old friend Ben Kabishta suggests that Sunderland was perhaps a cowhand who'd come up the trail from Texas and settled in Dakota Territory. A reference in State Historical Society documents supports this narrative. I don't think so. Sunderland's father hailed from New York, his mother from Wales, and in 1880, at age 17, he was living with them on Front Street of Bismarck, listing his occupation as farmer. In 1910, he was still single, rooming with a family on Mandan Avenue, listing his occupation as gardener, his employer as seed store. His obituary in 1916 explains that for 25 years he worked for Oscar Will's Seed Company. So there's the connection with songcatcher Will, an association that comprised more than the exchange of folk songs. In 1908, the Bismarck Tribune reports Will setting off on a geological expedition into the Badlands, accompanied by Sunderland and another older man, Otis Tye. Tye was a Bismarck resident who shortly would take up a homestead in Oliver County. Sunderland, I'm beginning to suspect, was the minder dispatched by old Oscar to look after young George. The newspaper in 1910 describes a float trip by the three men down the Missouri River from Glasgow, Montana, home to Bismarck. They paddled an 18-foot boat made on the pattern of a Chinook canoe built for them by Tye. It was mainly a pleasure trip, but Will also stopped to visit with reservation Indians and to scout archaeological sites. And, I like to think, enjoyed the singing of his companion, Sunderland. Will's other two informants, Steinbrück and Bivens, also were interesting characters. Steinbrück offered a lumberman's ballad called Shanty Teamster's Massiers, a ballad also related to the Buffalo Skinners. Ernest Reinhold Steinbrück was the immigrant son of a distinguished family in Dusseldorf, a German naval veteran, a former German language newspaper editor, a dedicated archaeologist, You can find his photographs and artifacts in the State Historical Society and the Smithsonian. And according to his obituary, a man of a genial disposition and his wide range of information on various topics made him an interesting conversationalist. Sometime in his life, he worked a few years in the timber of Ontario. And then we have Robert Arthur Bivens, the only real cowboy in the bunch, it seems. He was born in Lampasas, Texas, home today of, and I am not making this up, the world's largest spur, and came up the trail to Dakota Territory, married his wife Anna there, after which they settled on a farm near Braddock. I do not know how he was acquainted with George Will, but when Bivens sang Will the cowboy ballad, The Texas Cowboy, he was singing from experience.
Dr. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Coming up next on Main Street, Fighting Hunger During a Pandemic.
You can tour the working studios of some of Fargo-Moorhead's most popular artists during this year's Studio Crawl, October 3rd and 4th, noon to 6. See painters, potters, printers, photographers, fabric artists, and glass artists all demonstrating their work and talking about what life is like for a working artist. You can find Studio Crawl brochures at many locations around Fargo-Moorhead or find one at prairiepublic.org.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is Karen Ahrens. She is the Coalition Coordinator for Creating a Hunger-Free North Dakota, and September is Hunger Action Month. Karen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on, and I'm glad to be here during September Hunger Action Month.
I'm guessing this is quite a busy September. I'm sure it's always busy for you, but during a global pandemic, I imagine it's a little busier than normal?
Yes. September is this great month of harvest in our state, so people are wrapping up their gardens, giving them a great opportunity to donate any vegetables that they find that they have more than they can need to a local food pantry or soup kitchen. It's a time when we draw attention that amidst this plenty for many of us, there are also people that don't have enough to eat.
What kinds of numbers are you seeing right now, maybe this year compared with last, or just in more general terms, in terms of that need for food security?
Well, we need to look at several different indicators. Generally, the United States Department of Agriculture takes a look at past trends, and they will be soon releasing their new data for the 2017 to 2019 period. But we are really fortunate to have a new tool from the United States Census Bureau called the Household Pulse Data Survey. And that's giving us some real-time information. Mm-hmm. It started in April during the pandemic, and it's gathering information about how households are faring during the time of this COVID pandemic.
And what are you seeing in North Dakota?
In North Dakota, a year ago, we were talking about North Dakota experiencing one of the lowest food insecurity rates in the nation. Although over the 10 years or so, the rates had been slowly rising. But what families are experiencing now during a time of COVID is that families are eating more at home. And one third to one half of adults who completed the survey answered that they were not always finding enough food or the kinds of food that they were looking for, and mostly because food was unaffordable. So, and that they were not confident in finding food or being able to afford food in the next month as they were looking ahead. And this was from the period from between April and July this year. Some of the other things that are indicating that food insecurity and hunger are increasing in North Dakota is that the Great Plains Food Bank has seen more than a 40% increase in clients at their food pantries and mobile food distributions. Mm. That in a survey by the North Dakota Department of Commerce, nearly half of people acknowledged that finding enough food was an issue in their communities. Mm-hmm. And those are just some of the indicators that are showing us that having enough food to eat is of growing concern in North Dakota.
How much, if at all, is related to other people and their ability to donate to food banks and to food pantries? Or have people been hesitant, either just don't want to take from their own supply, or even just a matter of don't want to go into places and you know, interact more with COVID potential?
I believe that the Great Plains Food Bank is reporting that people are still stepping up to volunteer at food pantries and food banks because they are doing a lot of precautions to make sure that when people do volunteer or go in physically to help, mm-hmm. that they can do so safely. I think that as the economy has slowed, the amount of donations of monetary value have slowed down too, and so that has left nonprofits across the board looking to maintain or even retain donations. Mm.
You mentioned that part of the issue with an increased number of people having food insecurity issues is related to more people eating at home. I imagine the school year takes some of that food insecurity away. I guess I'll just start with it. Is that true?
Yes. In that Census Pulse survey, we were able to find out through the way that people answered the questions is that for families with children, over half of them found food at school or other programs aimed at children. So between 50 and 90% of families were finding help with food at school. Mm. So we know that school nutrition programs play a really important role. School is important for many reasons, and the ability to find breakfasts and lunches at school is one of the reasons. So it was so awesome how school districts across North Dakota stepped up this spring, and they changed in the matter of 2 or 3 days from preparing meals for children eating at school to preparing meals to be picked up and eaten at home. Mm-hmm. And school food service personnel are continuing to do an awesome job at responding to uncertain conditions, because in some schools, kids are doing all online learning. At others, it's all in person. And still other schools, it's a hybrid where children are at school some days and at home some days. So the amount of flexibility and responsiveness of school nutrition personnel in North Dakota and across the nation is remarkable.
And now in this school year, the USDA, which is the overarching program for the school lunches, has announced that it will increase funding for free meals to continue at least through December 31st. But as I understand it, school districts still have to opt in. Are you familiar with how the schools across the state are responding to this program?
Yes, in some of our larger cities, like Fargo and Bismarck, school districts have made the decision to provide meals at no charge to families, no matter what their income status is, but to help school districts make sure that they can get the maximum amount of reimbursement possible. It's really important that families complete the free and reduced price application, which helps to determine the amount of reimbursement per meal that a school district will receive. So I encourage any families who have experienced a change in work hours, less employment, to please complete one of those free or reduced price applications. Even though there may not be a charge for you to receive the school meals at school, mm-hmm. to go ahead and complete that application so that the school district can see the maximum value in providing those meals.
Okay. So it becomes kind of a data point collection at that point.
Right. It also is a determining factor for other programs in the school district, whether they can get funding and the amount of funding that they get. So still real important for families to complete that, which may come home or be sent through email from your school district administration.
What kinds of food insecurity issues can be addressed either negatively or positively by people filling out the census?
Oh, that's a really good question. And we, in September, are joining with others and encouraging people to please complete the census on your own. Or if someone comes knocking at their door, they'll be identified with badges, with information that says that they're with the census, to please respond to that, because having complete information on the number of people in North Dakota helps to obtain maximum funding for federal nutrition programs in the state. It helps determine how much our state gets for the SNAP program, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, for the National School Lunch and School Breakfast Program, for the Child Care Food Program, for WIC, and for special programs for the aging, like those Meals on Wheels and meal programs at senior centers. So all those federal nutrition programs are impacted by our census numbers. So again, if people can please cooperate and fill in that information so that we get the federal funding to make sure that we can meet the needs of people in our state, that would be wonderful.
We're visiting today with Karen Ahrens, the coordinator for the Creating a Hunger-Free North Dakota Coalition. You can find out more at hungerfreend.org. And September is Hunger Action Month. And one of the organizations that I'm really intrigued by taking action to address food insecurity is the Sportsmen Against Hunger program. I know deer season is coming right up. I don't know too much more about the other hunting seasons, but I know that one is coming up. How is the Sportsmen Against Hunger program working?
It's a great program, and it's organized and managed by the Community Action Partnership of North Dakota. And so their goal is to increase the amount of legally obtained game meat, mainly from venison or deer meat and goose meat. If people, again, just like if you have more than you can eat from your garden, if you have more than you can eat from your hunting experiences, you can donate them. And you can take those to processors who do agree to participate in the program. And then Sportsmen Against Hunger raises donations to help pay for the cost of processing that meat. And then it gets donated to food pantries across the state, which provides a really good source of protein for families who are looking for some help with food.
I noticed that you said legally obtained game meat. Has there been an issue with illegally obtained meat?
No, I don't think so, but that's just one of the ways that they want to help make sure that things are on the straight and narrow.
Yeah. I was on your website earlier, and I noticed that in maps across the state, there is this concept of a food desert where people have to travel many, many miles to get access to healthy food. And also on that map were all these little red dots, and that dot was specifically for Dollar General. And I've been really intrigued by these Dollar Generals popping up. It feels like overnight in these communities. And I remember some months ago, one of the national newspapers had an extensive article on Dollar General going into places where for example, a Walmart won't go just because of size. Can you talk about the role of Dollar General in both the ability to get food into maybe food scarce areas, but then also the quality, the healthy quality of the food that might be there?
Well, those stores have an aggressive agenda to increase the number of them across the country. And there have been a growing number of these dollar stores in the state. While they may provide some sources of food, for the most part, they don't have freezer or coolers in them. And so you're not able to get perishable foods like fruits and vegetables and dairy products and many meat products. So taking that into consideration, it may not provide a fully balanced menu of foods to select from. Also, there have been some articles that have highlighted that sometimes the package sizes in these stores are different from the package sizes in your grocery store. And while it seems that it may be a good deal, like the package sizes, although similar in the package size, may have different weights. So just some things to pay attention to as people are shopping. Grocery stores, the rural grocery stores in North Dakota, have done a super job at stepping up to keep food available closer to home during the pandemic. Many of them have seen their businesses increase, and they've been trying really hard to make sure that they're still there for their customers who they know may not be able to travel far. There's even now some CARES Act funding available to rural grocery stores to increase the amount of refrigeration and freezing space available so that some of those more healthy perishable foods can be more available in our state. And this is a great way that the North Dakota Department of Agriculture is administering this grant to help increase availability and accessibility of foods now and into the future.
Less than a minute left, Karen. What do you hope on Election Day people take in mind with them as they go to the polls, if they didn't already vote, of course, by mail?
Well, as a member of the League of Women Voters, I just encourage everyone to go out and vote and don't waste that hard-won right that people have. And as they're talking with candidates, to ask them specifically what they believe solutions or roles, how they might help make sure that people across North Dakota have enough to eat.
Karen Ahrens is the coordinator for the Creating a Hunger-Free North Dakota Coalition. You can find out more at hungerfreend.org. Karen, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Ashley. And Hunger Action Month, everyone. Everyone can play a role.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 9th. During this week in 1884, a post office was established at Morganville on the old stage route between Bismarck and Fort Stevenson. Morganville was nothing more than a farm on the west edge of what is now Beulah in Mercer County. The owner and postmaster was an unusual man who went by Frank C. Morgan, Morgan Spencer, and Long-Haired Morgan. Nobody seemed to know where he came from, but it was apparent the fellow was well-educated. Perhaps with a romantic notion of the Western frontier, he had chosen a lifestyle of hunting and trapping. He was colorful and somewhat eccentric, wearing his black hair long and flowing. He always carried a Bowie knife, an object that later led to a significant event in his life.
Morgan lived on Spring Creek in a cabin built of logs, rocks, and sod. Inside, a trapdoor opened into a 300-foot tunnel, which ended in thick brush along the creek bank. With no explanation of the tunnel's purpose, some neighbors began speculating that Morgan was on the run from the law. No one knew. But several years after Morgan established his post office, he disappeared. In the early 1890s, long-haired Morgan abruptly reappeared with a traveling entertainment show. Now his black hair was tied back with a red bandana, and he dressed in heavily fringed buckskin and gleaming black high-topped boots. Having honed his skills, Morgan had put together a perilous knife-throwing act. His show booth consisted of a wall of planks against which stood a pretty woman, his new wife, with her arms horizontally outstretched. Morgan would step back 8 paces and select a bowie knife from his prop table, and then, one by one, he outlined her body with 18 knives. Morgan moved on with the show and reportedly wasn't heard from again. However, word drifted back to Mercer County that his aim had finally failed, and his wife was dead. Today's Dakota Date Book, written by Mary Helm. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Date Book is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
New York City is reopening courthouses closed by coronavirus. Inside?
This is the quietest trial I've ever had.
The courts face a backlog of cases and new safety procedures.
Just the logistics of when you can only put one or two people in an elevator at a time, it takes forever.
On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we visit with Deborah Davis. She is the author of Guest of Honor, Booker T. Washington, Theodore Roosevelt, and the Dinner That Shocked the Nation. She will be speaking at the upcoming virtual Theodore Roosevelt Symposium. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.